What does Hard Rock, the Naval Academy, football, Marine Corps, and the MARSOC Raiders have in common? Tyson Stahl. Stand by for a powerful two-part interview with this military veteran and modern-day Renaissance man.
Welcome to the WFO Life Podcast. Buckle up for interviews, insights, and practical discussions, and the occasional intellectual oddity, all designed to help you master self, master craft, and accomplish any life mission.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to WFO Live Podcast. As usual, the Doc and I think have a good episode for you, good guest tonight. As always, we want to tease out things that help us to master ourselves and master our craft and accomplish any life mission. So I think tonight our guest is going to hopefully tell us some stories about how he's done just that. So I'd like to welcome Tyson Stahl to the podcast. Hey, Tyson.
Hey, Chris. Really appreciate you guys having me on here tonight and really love what you guys are doing. You know, getting to know you here over the past, I guess it's been almost a year now.
Oh, yeah.
You know, kind of working through TMF and all that, and learning more about the podcast and what it's about and what you guys do. Really am honored to be here. So thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Tyson. I think, reviewing some of the things that, you know, we like to learn and looking at your bio, I honestly think that's probably a good place to start. And if you could maybe just tell us a little bit about, you know, first of all, I guess I'll put a couple tidbits out there. We may have a bumper where we kind of read maybe a more extended bio, but you know, Tyson, you know, went to the Naval Academy, was a football player there, became a Marine, and obviously we'll get more into some of those stories. Ended up being in a rock band and, you know, working in a business world and being a coach. And so hopefully if we can, you know, tease out, you know, a few lessons from each one of those life events that you've had, I think we'll have a fun time. But I guess we can just start out, like, you know, tell us a little bit about your upbringing and, you know, maybe the road and how you got to the Naval Academy.
Yeah, sure. So, excuse me. So I was born in Raleigh, North Carolina. My dad was a basketball player at UNC Chapel Hill in the early 70s. So, you know, I at 6'4", I'm the smallest male in my family, right? My dad was 6'10", and my brother, my brother's 6'6". So, you know, so I'm the younger of two. Mom was a teacher. And, you know, when I was growing up, you know, my parents were just really good about sort of exposing my brother and I to everything. I mean, we did everything from theater. We both took dance, like tap and ballet.
I gotta find those videos. You know, that would be gold right there. But anyway, so
yeah, they exist. My mom's got all the old VHS stuff. But playing musical instruments, sports. I mean, just the whole nine, right? And looking back, I'm really grateful for that because it just exposed me to so many things. You know, and my brother as well. And so, you know, he and I are 5 years apart. So when I was in, you know, probably the sixth grade, I got a guitar for Christmas, and that was like right around the time. Yeah. It's like 1993 frame.
Just pre grunge beginnings. Right. So,
yeah. So it was really, it was kind of technically on the back end of grunge, like Woodstock 94 was happening. Mm-hmm. And I just fell in love with hard rock music, man. I mean, it was, I was hooked right away. But as happens with that, sometimes I started listening to a lot of punk rock as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that guitar led to like one or two lessons. Having played instruments before, I had an ear for it, you know, kind of taught myself to play songs just by listening. met two guys in the hallway in the seventh grade, and they were like, "Hey, we need another guitar player. Do you want to play with us?" I was like, "Yeah, dude, I'd love to." So started a punk band at, I don't know, probably 12 and a half years old. And
so were you, playing sports at that time too, or?
Not really. I actually got cut from the seventh grade football team. And in fact, I'm glad you asked that question, man. Cause I met the guy who ended up being our actual guitar player after reading the roster that told me that I had been cut from the high school or the middle school football team. Nice. You know, it's like, I don't want to be some dumb jock anyway.
Rock on.
Sean was the other guitarist, and Jody Matthews was our drummer, and we became thick as thieves, man. We started playing music all the time. Well, concurrently with this, my brother was this like standout high school football player.
Yeah.
So I'm like the punk little brother, and I've got like the jock multi, you know, three sport Letterman, older brother. And, it's like a classic, you know, sitcom scenario.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, as it turns out though, the band was actually, we were like really talented. And so we were playing, we played a couple shows with like these older bands at these like bars, you know, in the afternoon on a Saturday and stuff. Like our parents are driving us there. My dad's cool. Helping us offload equipment. My brother is getting a lot of looks for college football, and he ends up deciding he wants to go to the Naval Academy. Excuse me. So, I concurrently was like getting in a ton of trouble, and my after the seventh grade, my parents were like, "Look, you have a choice here. Like, you can go to spend your summer at this military school in, you know, kind of Western North Carolina, and then if you don't do well there, we're going to keep you there, or you can just straighten up." And I was like, "You know what? Just send me. Let's just do it. Let's, you know, go all in." And they did. My mom always tells a story like God and the military were the only two things that were going to save me at that point. So they like, they packed my summer with church camp and then sent me off to military school.
It's kind of like being, what they say back in the day, UDP to Okinawa, you either find God, you find the gym, or you find the bottle, you know? So,
Well, so, and at this same time, though, my brother had just left to go to the Naval Academy Preparatory School up in Newport, Rhode Island, which is kind of, most commonly, it's the athletic feeder, for athletes that are just need a little bit more STEM education.
Yeah.
So I got to see him do that. And we went in, you know, we went as a family to his induction day. And then I, you know, came back and started my sort of indoc at Oak Ridge Military Academy. It's a little bit past Greensboro, North Carolina. I actually found that I like really loved that sort of structure and discipline, you know. My dad used to tell this story that one time he was like driving us to a show, and I've got like my hair all spiked up, and my parents discovered that I had pierced my nose at one point because they read my yearbook, and I was like able to hide it from them for a while. And, my dad was like, "Why are you doing this?" And I, at that age, I had the wherewithal to say, you know, "I know this is a phase. Like, this is going to, I'm going to grow out of this."
I got to get out of my system. You're like, "Dad, if I don't get this out of my system now, I'm not going to be a successful adult," you know?
So. So anyway, you know, but my time at Oak Ridge is when I was exposed to football and wrestling, and I loved wrestling. I didn't fully, you know, grasp football. I mean, football is a very complex sport. And so to play it for the first time as an eighth grader with a bunch of high schoolers, you know, I just didn't get it. But I loved wrestling, and I sort of loved that sort of interpersonal violence and the one-on-one kind of component of success and failure. And just putting myself out there. So, I spent that year, came back, to public high school in Raleigh. I sort of passed the parents, you know, sniff test, and they're like, "All right, you can come home now." And, got to keep playing music with the band. And my brother ended up just being like a really awesome offensive lineman for Navy. And over, you know, he started as a sophomore at offensive tackle, wow. which is, you know, pretty unheard of. And he had a turf toe injury his junior year, but he started for 3 years and, you know, was a legitimate NFL prospect. And wow. So I watched him do that. And, you know, at the same time, I'm going through high school, and then I started playing football in the 10th grade and started to grasp it a little bit better. I was a defensive end, and just, you know, I was like 6'4", 215, 220 when I graduated high school. So I was, you know, just much bigger, you know, at that time. Yeah. But really relevant circumstance happened. So when I was a sophomore, our band kind of dissolved, and I kept playing though with our drummer Jody. And then Jody and I wrestled together, and long story short, Jody ended up getting diagnosed with a very rare form of a pediatric cancer. Jeez. And yeah, and when he was diagnosed, they thought he had pneumonia, you know, and they took him in because he was having trouble breathing. I remember that day of wrestling practice like it was yesterday. I mean, he just looked terrible, you know. And it was right at Thanksgiving. It was my birthday weekend. And, you know, I remember the wrestling coach called me on the morning of my 16th birthday and saying, "Hey, Jody has tumors all in his torso and the doctors are giving him 72 hours to live. So the family just asked me to call you to have you come out." And, I came out, you know, he was at Duke Pediatric, you know, and was working with a great oncologist out there. And he survived that weekend, you know, but, you know, here I am, I'm like 16 years old on the day, pushing my best friend into the ICU, you know, this guy who's deathly afraid of needles, and Jeez. Watching him, you know, just get jabbed. And, you know, it was, you know, it's just a lot. I mean, my pulse goes up every time I kind of
thinking about
you
it. Know, yeah.
relive that, because it I think it's taken me many years to sort of process even just that moment. But you know, I watched Jody fight this thing for 2 years, and you know, when he graduated high school, he wrestled again, even with the shunts, you know, like in his system, and he still had his ports, you know, and it was really incredible stuff. I left for a bunch of football camps one summer. When I came back, my mom was waiting for me in the parking lot with a family friend who was like a mutual family friend. And they said, "Hey, you know, he's kind of taking a turn for the worst. He's moved back home. And so, you know, November 9th of my senior year, 2000, you know, we had just lost our last football game the weekend before. And, if we had won, we would have been on the road that day to go to a playoff game. And, I got home, you know, it was back when voicemail had like the beep, beep, beep dial tone. And, I remember just getting home and checking that. And it was his dad, and he said, "Hey, you should probably pack a bag and just come on over." And I got there, and, you know, within about 30 minutes of me getting there, he kind of woke up, and it, you know, we just sort of knew, you know, he was ready to go. You know, I got to be with him for that, you know, and with his mom and his dad and his sister, and his girlfriend and his aunt, and, it was like the people who were there 2 years earlier were the same people who were there that day. And
it's pretty powerful at that age to have people just that connected with a friend, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, so that was like the first, real close interaction I had with, loss, with any of those things. And looking back, I realize what a role that incident played in sort of the career path I ended up on, you know? And
Tyson, I wanted to comment what you just said. I'm enjoying your story. Maturity is what happens when as a physician, I see people that sometimes traumatic things happen to them. And like you said, your pulse rate goes up. It's kind of a still emotional after many years. That was something that probably was a catalyst for, like, you know, accelerated maturity. Because even there's a lot of people that are 18, 19, 20 years old. I'm sure you knew Marines and stuff that aren't very mature, you know, 5 years older than that. But something like that, man, when young people have to experience death close, either a loss of a close friend or a family member, it's like people, they age, just maturity goes way up. Cause it's a pretty stark reality to realize, hey, you know, life's pretty finite, and you know, you don't think about that normally at 16 years old, but that's a powerful story.
Yeah.
Ahead, Chris. Sorry.
I was just going to say, when you were talking to, and I don't know if we ever shared this cause I remember you telling me part of that story before. And, like when I was in eighth grade, my mom had lung cancer, and I think she got it diagnosed with it and actually had a lung removed when I was in seventh grade. And then, you know, lung cancer is always a bad deal. And, you know, she lived maybe a little bit more than a year after that. But I actually watched my mom take her last breath when I was an eighth grader. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I, you know, even being an eighth grader and having it be a vivid memory, I don't know if I was ready to process all that. And then, you know, soon after that, we moved, you know, we'd bounced back and forth between Georgia and Texas with my dad's job. And so my dad had a military background, but, you know, got out before I was born. So it was kind of funny that we ended up moving a lot when I was growing up, like we were in the military. And then my mom died in eighth grade. So I know that, you know, that was a formative thing for me. And, you know, I didn't go right into the military, but I think, you know, like you, a lot of parallels to what I ended up doing, and, you know, how I dealt with things, sometimes better, sometimes worse dealing with things, had to do probably with that stuff that we maybe both experienced when we were younger.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, one of the things that also looking back, I kind of recognize is, you know, as I've been just processing a lot of stuff, you know, that has happened over the last couple of decades. You know, there are a lot of parts of my college years that I just, like, my buddies remember everything and I remember very little. And especially in those first 2 years. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think I was still very much wrapped in the grief process and just, you know, those signs of post-traumatic stress and all the stuff that I learned later in life. I was like, I know that, you know, and, you know, so I guess really kind of getting back into the story, I you know, after that happened, I started getting some, you know, real looks for football, and Navy was one of them. And, you know, at that point I'd been up there so many times, it felt like home. And there was a chance because, you know, my brother and I are so academically stellar that we actually are like two of the very few December graduates from the U.S. Naval Academy. you know, I was able to go and spend a semester with him in the fall of 2001. Cool. And, you know, so did that, went up there, you know, checked in June. Sure enough, my brother's getting ready to commission into the Marine Corps that December, and, the 9/11 attacks happened. You know, just, you know, being a midshipman at the Naval Academy when that's happening, you know, watching,
y'all probably get put on lockdown, huh?
Oh, big time. You had to have an ID card on you. They had midshipmen standing between like the wings and the hallways between the various wings with like a bayonet, like a drill, you know, the shiny drill bayonet, you know,
jeez,
like, you know, what are you going to do? But yeah, they locked it down. I mean, they still had a company of infantry Marines that were the security force there at the time. And they built bunkers with standoff and 240s in them and, you know, rockets. I mean, I remember all that, but, yeah, so, you know, ended up playing ball there. And then our head coach got fired halfway through my freshman season. My brother graduated that December, and then Paul Johnson came in to be our new head coach and started what would end up being, you know, almost two decades of Navy winning the Commander in Chief's Trophy and beating Army consistently. And we, you know, it was just cool to be part of that rebuild. And I think when I look back at my experience at the Naval Academy, it's really defined by my time as a football player. Not necessarily playing football, but you know, the service academies are so unique in that if you are a varsity athlete, you are sort of automatically by default isolated from the non-varsity athletes, and even more so the athletes that don't play sports in the same season as you.
Right.
Just because you're like never around, you know. Yeah. If you're a travel squad guy, you leave on Thursday. You know, you get up early to go get treatment. You knock out a casual 19 or 20 credit hours of a science, math, engineering, you know, based curriculum. Like I have a BS in English. It's like the most useless degree ever.
Yeah. But people are like, how's that possible? Bachelor of Science in English, but I digress.
Yeah. So, you know, but we it was just really amazing though, you know, looking back at the athletic part, being part of a program that went from, I mean, we were literally like, it was between us and Army the year I showed up as to like, who was the worst team in college football.
Yeah. Tough.
My senior year, we finished 10-2 first time. Well, sorry. We were the winningest team in 99 years. I think at that point, in the fall of 2004, went to a bowl game for the second year in a row, beat New Mexico, who had one of the top rushing defenses in the country at the time, actually posted the longest offensive drive in major football history. It was like 14 minutes and 26 seconds of play clock. It was 20 some plays, and it was 99 yards, and we ended with a field goal.
Wow. Well, you know what? You know what, though, Tyson, we talked a little bit about the high school we went to. You know, our coach would have been proud of that. You talk about, you know, 2 or 3 yards and a cloud of dust, and own the clock. You know, no turnovers, and you know, that's the kind of smash mouth football that we grew up with.
It's a classic Phil Danaher style football there for sure.
But one of the things that you said, Tyson, I remember I worked with Drew Thompson. I think I probably told you that.
Yep.
And you know, he came back. I think, was he like the team mentor at all when you were there?
I think I just missed him. So that's one of the cool things about the Navy football program is that there's always been a Marine officer, officer rep, right? Is like an 06 who works on the yard, who is like the senior, you know, officer mentor to the team. But then there's I think it's the director of player development.
Yeah, it's like a mentor for the team, right, or something.
Yeah, and it's a guy who's really the actual liaison between, you know, what we call the hall, right? Kind of like your actual duties as a midshipman, you know, in that world, and then your you know, Ricketts Hall world, you know, Ricketts being where the locker room is and stuff. Mm-hmm. And those guys, you know, Navy football has always had like a Marine Corps flavor to it. Sure. That's not to say that every year, you know, most of the seniors go. But you know, when my brother graduated, at least three of the guys from his offensive line all went Marine infantry. And there were a couple other guys that went, and, you know, and so while I'm playing ball, my brother's going through Quantico and IOC, and he went through TBS with you, and you know, then he goes out to the West Coast, you know, finishes the infantry officer course in the fall of 2002. You know, our family sees him and he says, look, I'm getting on a boat in January. He gets on a boat to Kuwait and loads up in an AAV and crosses the LD in March of 2003. right? Yeah. And his battalion ended up spending like, I think in my memory, it was 10 months. I know that they were there longer than most of the infantry battalions who were part of the initial invasion. You know, and he was, he did that, came back. So that was my sophomore football season. He came back kind of towards the end of that. And then my, And then my senior year, he left again, did OIF two. Yeah. So that would have been actually my junior season. And then, my senior year, I remember I'm in camp. It's 2004. We're in two-a-days. And one of the last emails I got from him before he just kind of went off the net for a while was like, yep, like there's a helicopter crash, lots of gunfire. Like, I'll check in a few days. And what subsequently became the Battle of Najaf. Mm-hmm. And when that helicopter crash happened, one of his sister platoon commanders took a bunch of RPG shrapnel to the face, and what sort of kicked off that battle, and he ended up at Bethesda. So, you know, I got a football signed and a poster signed for him, and went over to Bethesda, you know, to give him this thing, not realizing that I'm literally going to the epicenter of all the wounded Marines and sailors in the worst year of the Iraq War. I mean, this is between, you know, both Fallujahs and all that. And, total eye-opening experience for me. So then you fast forward to that September, we're getting ready for our season opener against Duke. It's a night game. It's a home game. I go to walk into our breakfast that morning. And I'm like pushing the timeline, and I'm thinking, shit, I'm late. You know, my coach is going to kick my ass. And everyone's staring at me. And then one of our GAs pulls me aside and says, hey, Ronnie Winchester was killed. And Ronnie had been a teammate of my brother's who played tackle opposite my brother. So Hoot was a right tackle and Ronnie played left tackle.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I called my mom and let her know. You know, I had no way of getting in touch with Hoot at the time because he was obviously overseas. And I called Ron's mom and said, hey, you know, I'm here with the team at the hotel. And I just want you to know, like, we're going to play this game for your son. And, you know, kind of the brotherhood's here, you know. And we get in the locker room before the game, and our equipment manager comes up and he says, hey, the captains want you to lead the team out of the tunnel with the American flag. I was like, yeah, you know, I'll do that. And so I did it, and we won. And I got to do that for every game that year.
That's cool.
Which, you know, when I, to this day, like, coolest thing I've ever done, you know.
Yeah.
I mean,
I can only imagine that, especially with, you know, you eventually gonna, you know, knew by then you probably were gonna be a Marine, and then, you know, having your brother deployed and, you know, teammates getting killed. I mean, you don't need much else to kind of burn something into your soul than run out of the tunnel in front of thousands of fans with the American flag. I mean, that's pretty incredible.
You said it. And we had two teammates get killed that year. JP Blacksmith was killed in Fallujah, and actually, you know, Tosh spoke about him when we were in Colorado. And Scott Swantner, who played guard next to my brother, was pretty seriously wounded that year too. And, you know, so we were watching our teammates, you know, and the guys that we looked up to. I mean, a lot of us went on recruiting visits with those guys, you know. Just completely give everything they had, you know, to the fight. And I was like, that's what we're going to do. And, you know, so finished my senior year and, or senior season, and we're on a flight to a bowl game. And, come to find out, I'm going to end up graduating late and have a chance to play another year. And, long story short, I turned it down. I didn't want to have to spend 6 months, you know, losing weight and further delay when, you know, I'm playing on a team that's got, I mean, I forget how many seniors, but it was something like 30 seniors. And a bunch of us are going Marine Corps. A bunch of us are Marine ground and want to be infantry officers. And I was like, man, I cannot in good conscience, you know, stay here to play a game and then burn 6 months losing weight while these guys are like inevitably spending 10 months in Quantico and going out the door. So,
yeah.
You know, I took that extra semester to just make sure I did graduate and lost my weight and went to the basic school and, you know.
Well, it's funny, a few things you mentioned that I maybe want to go back through. First of all, when I mentioned Drew Thompson, I remember him, I think, talking about that transition with Paul Johnson. And, you know, like you said, a lot of the Naval Academy football players became Marines. And so there's a lot of people that I was in the basic school with, including your brother, and other people that I had. I actually taught at a Marine school in Newport, Rhode Island. For a few years, like we had our, you know, MOS school there. So I was there, you know, co-located with Naps, and there was Andrew Berger, I think, that was, I don't know if he played with you or around the same time or not, but anyway, they talked about, you know, Coach Johnson, I'm sure there was a culture shift to be able to rebuild that team. And obviously he went on to coach, you know, at other big programs. So can you maybe talk a little bit about, you know, how the culture shift, like what he brought, that you, I mean, obviously you physically experienced that happening, and that's something we like to tease out, is about cultures and, you know, how to build and change culture. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was actually just having this conversation, the other day. I mean, Coach Johnson came into a program that had, you know, we probably had 200 people on the roster. You know, we service academies aren't bound by scholarships, you know, yeah. So, you know, we kind of had, it was a cast a wide net sort of mentality. And, you know, but he came in with an offense that has a very specific set of rules, right? I mean, the triple option as he runs it, you know, everyone has a rule. It's if then stuff. And it's not a long list, right?
Like, yeah,
your playbook is basically like one sheet of paper, you know, and it gives you your rule, mm-hmm. Relative to where people are aligned on the field. And, you know, but yeah, he came in, and everybody who's ever played football at the Naval Academy, can speak about fourth quarter, certainly within the Johnson years. And I know, Coach Niemot does the same. So our turf field, outside our locker room, our practice field was, it's called Rick Miller. And it used to just be this like shitty old AstroTurf, right? Like it was probably laid when AstroTurf was first a thing,
yeah.
You know, and fourth quarters happen right before the start of spring ball. It's like the 2 weeks before spring ball. And it's usually the week before spring break and the week after spring break, which is like the most strategic thing ever. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so Coach Johnson came in, right before Christmas break. Like he officially got the job. We didn't really see him or interact with him until, you know, other than like his intro meeting. And then, you know, when we started weights in January. So we, you know, we're all getting after it, trying to, you know, make a good impression. Fourth quarters come around, and the way fourth quarters work was, I want to say it was like eight stations, maybe six stations, you know, all over, spread around the field. And you're going by position group and you spend like 2 minutes at each station. Right. And then, you know, so you might have like the wave drill, right, where the coach is, you know, having you change directions, or yeah. Monkey rolls or bag drills, or the worst was the cone drill, which was, you know, four cones, or I'm sorry, not the cone drill, the towel drill, four towels in a box, and you'd run and you'd put your right hand down on that towel and do like the curly, you know, spin run thing from the Three Stooges.
Yeah.
And then get up and run to the next one and put, you know, your hand down. And it was like that was the one that made guys throw up. And so you go through every station, you get a 5 minute water break. You go back, you go through every station again for like a minute and a half. And then after that second time through, you'd go to each station and it would only be like 30 seconds or a minute or something like that. And then you'd have to get a perfect breakdown with the coach that was running it, and you'd have to sprint to the next station. And if you get a thumbs up all the way around, you're done.
Right.
We started at like 4:30 in the morning, and there's like snow pushed up on the sides of this turf field. It was completely miserable. I mean, you're on the Chesapeake Bay, right? It's a cold January morning or February morning. We were like, most of us missed breakfast that day. But because we like the sun came up, you know, it was probably some beautiful sunrise too that
you couldn't appreciate.
Yeah. But, you know, and he told us, you know, afterwards, he was like, you know, and some phrases that I won't repeat here, but, you know, he basically just told us we were not mentally tough, or disciplined enough to play at the level that he expected us to play. You know, you fast forward, we had a pretty bad year the next year. I mean, we won two games, and the tagline for Navy football when he came in was expect to win. And I remember that first senior class, you know, a lot of people used to joke, you know, yeah, expect to win two games. Right. And
yeah,
you know, that sucked, but his whole staff and so Coach Niumatalolo, the head coach there now, was our head offensive line coach. And so when I moved from, because I was recruited as a DN. So when I moved over to the offensive line in the spring of my sophomore year, you know, there, I really got to see what Paul Johnson was about. And it's just unrelenting attention to detail. He demands total focus and attention. And look, don't hear me saying that I was like the pinnacle of any of those things, because it took me a long time to sort of just mature to be the type of player that was, you know, worthy of a starting position by my senior year. But looking back, you know, that culture shift came from literally zero tolerance of anything but winning habits. I mean, you had to be in the weight room. You had to be busting your ass in sprints. Like and all the coaches reinforced it. You know, I mean, that's Buddy good, Green yeah. came in as the defensive coordinator and you know, brought his like 50 package. And I mean, you want to talk about some tenacious dudes. The guys that he had on that defense were, just fearless, man. And, you know, but, the class that came ahead of me, the class of 2004, you know, Craig Candido was the quarterback. You know, the offensive line guys ahead of me, Josh Gooden, Shane Todd, you know, Tucker Bennett. I mean, just a bunch of those guys, man, they were the ones that bought in though, you know, and because you know, coaches often get the credit for turning a program around, but there's always that one class that goes all in, right? They buy in 100% and say, this is going to be the year it changes. And man, those guys, their work ethic was unbelievable.
So they said they did like what, you know, we like to talk about in the Marine Corps. They set the example, right? Everybody, it wasn't just the coaching staff. It was the leaders within the team, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was it, you know, and that year we started winning some games and, you know, put together an 8-win season, but that was the first year we'd beaten Air Force like since the '90s and, you know, and won the Commander in Chief's trophy for the first time since I think also the '90s. And, I remember that Air Force game. We were playing at FedEx Field. And there was like a big, I don't remember the sequence, but we like recovered an onside kick. And basically, you know, we were able to run down the clock I mean, dudes are doing cartwheels on the field, like big linemen are doing cartwheels on the field and just being super excited about it. Yeah. It was, awesome. Yeah, it was amazing, man. And then, you know, we ended up beating Army pretty well that year. And you know, it was just, it was cool, man. So for our class, the expectation was like, you know, don't fuck this up.
Yeah. You know? It's funny. We talked to one of the coaches there from Cal Allen, you know, and a high school example of a kind of a culture of excellence. Like I think I told you a little bit, Tyson, you know, winning 10 games a year for like 20 plus years in a row, you know, in competitive Texas high school football. And so we talked to one of their defensive coaches about that. And it sounds like you experienced that. Like once you get that feeling of victory, it's like no team wants to be the team that lets down that legacy, right? And so and there's all, I mean, I think there's probably some stuff like this at the Naval Academy, but I know even in our high school alma mater, you know, they're like, you know, tradition never graduates and, you know, all this stuff. And you know, just the aura of a program like that becomes, you know, worth 7 points on the scoreboard when you play home games, you know. I mean, it honestly is just like that culture of excellence. So that the way you wove that together was good because you know, it ties into a lot of other examples we've seen. Like yesterday we had a you know, a guy from the UK that's a professional soccer player now in South Texas. And, you know, he just talked about, you know, building grit, you know, from some adversity. Mm-hmm. And it's like, if you have things way too easy, you know, a lot of times, you know, it's hard to, you know, deal with, you know, that adversity, you know, like when you feel it for the first time, you know? And so mm-hmm. I think, you know, you seeing that transition probably helped. And so, you know, just to maybe fast forward a little bit, about, you know, culture and transitions. I think one of the notes I had is talking about that transition, you know, from the Naval Academy to the Marine Corps, you know, especially having your brother, you know, really just right before you, having gone through the same thing. So maybe talk a little bit about the, you know, culture shifts and shocks maybe about that.
Yeah. So, you know, like I said, I was a delayed graduate, it was me and one other guy getting commissioned, you know, in December of 05. And, I checked into TBS like January 4th, you know, got my Christmas leave and went and checked in and And then, you know, TBS was, I was in a class that was mostly OCS graduates.
Yeah. Cause that was the, were you in Bravo Company or?
Yep. Yep. Okay. Bravo Company. And you know, for, you know, anybody who's been to the basic school, you know, has an idea of this, but typically the Naval Academy classes sort of all go to one of two training companies. And it's all Naval Academy, you know, alum. And it's, from what I understand, you know, it's not that it's different, but when you have all students that are familiar with talking to captains and majors and lieutenant colonels, you know, mm-hmm. like every day, I think some of that sort of rigor and structure, sort of has to meet them in the middle, right? Because it's not someone who's just coming straight from OCS. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you're also a little bit removed from, a lot of the, like very rudimentary field craft components that the OCS, graduates do have very fresh on their mind. So there was certainly a culture shock there because I felt like I was back in plebe summer, with a lot of folks. Like, and I think a lot of the staff didn't appreciate that I was a little low and loose, you know, with my demeanor and the way I addressed them and whatnot. And, you know, like I think I refused to get my hair cut every week. I probably wasn't the best second lieutenant to ever go through.
So, you know, this is probably a good segue to talk about something that's, you know, kind of cool but harsh in the Marine Corps culture is the spear eval, you know?
Yeah.
So how did that go with your peer evals? Or did you still do okay because they knew you were a good guy?
Yeah, I mean, from what I remember, I did okay. It was probably the same way I was received, you know, in the hall at the academy. You know, yeah. The people that spent the time to get to know me appreciated me. The people who just sort of took me at face value thought I was a dumb meathead. So,
yeah, you know. Good times,
yeah. Yeah. So, but yeah, it was a total culture shock in a lot of ways, but it also wasn't. I mean, I had been surrounded by so many Marine officers and also really awesome staff NCOs in Annapolis. Mm-hmm. I mean, our senior enlisted rep for the football team was a guy named JD Baker, who he and I keep in touch to this day. He was a scout sniper, you know, he was a gunny at the time, retired as a master sergeant. And that guy, you know, he was one of the people that I felt like, dude, I get to work with, you know, enlisted Marines like him. Like, I gotta do that, you know? Yeah. But you know, once I got there, it was like a no brainer. And it, like, I knew I wanted to be an infantry officer. You know, we went in the field the first time. I was like, I can't get enough of this. and actually, like day one, I met a guy who had become one of my closest friends to this day. You know, we ended up being platoon commanders together and we're at MARSOC at the same time. And he's like my size. And we met on the pull-up bar at the PFT, right? So like egging each other on, and then we're on the run and I'm like struggling and I just hear these like big footsteps behind me. And he's like, come on, dude, we got to finish this. You know, and that PFT course, the back half is all uphill, right?
Yeah, so it sucks. Yeah.
So you're hoofing it. And I ran like my best PFT ever, that back stretch with him. You know, but once, you know, once we got into the groove of it, you know, my best recollection is that I was like ready to get my MOS and go across the street. You know, I wanted to go to the infantry officer course, and prove myself, you know, as a infantry platoon commander. And when I got picked for that, you know, I toyed with, you know, I looked at some other MOSs, but I just kind of knew like, that's where I need to be, right? That's kind of where my personality fit and the things that I liked about the Marine Corps were all in that field. So,
Being in Quantico, especially at that time, I think from the time I was there really through, I mean, it's probably still like that now, but I think they made everybody want to be an infantry officer.
It's like
if you didn't put infantry as your first choice, you were going to get looked down upon if you didn't have like a public affairs officer as your, you know, platoon commander, right? So you know, one of the things, and I think it'll be cool to you know, talk about this is you know, the infantry officer course is, you know, in some ways the specialties you get selected for, it's just another MOS school, but as everybody knows about the culture, you know, it's one of the harder schools, I think, you know, of that type and, you know, probably the world, honestly. And was Tosh one of your instructors there at the,
he was a class proctor. Yeah.
So no big deal having the, Navy Cross recipient as your, you know, MOS school instructor. Right. So,
So
talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So Tosh, you know, he was already a legend at that point. You know, he had been featured on a documentary that was on Fox News that followed his company through Phantom Fury. I knew who he was because he had been JP's company commander. And then, you know, you get to the basic school and he's an instructor at IOC and he's like walking around with no skivvy shirt on and kind of like doing his own thing, you know. And dude, he, you know, if anyone who's met him, right, you feel his energy.
Yeah.
And you're like, that guy's going to be my proctor. Like he's going to be the class advisor who like puts me through the infantry officer course. And I was in a class where IOC actually started. So we did the CET before I finished TBS.
That's crazy, yeah.
Yeah, so we knocked out the CET. The whole class failed it, whatever yeah. that means. And then we had to do it again, you know,
That's the indoctrination period for IOC, right? For those who don't know. So,
yeah, it's a day long sort of physical. It's a multiple skills assessment. I mean, it includes components of weapons familiarization, land nav, McMap, and just like some serious mental toughness. I mean, it's just a long day. So we've gone through that. We're getting our first couple courses and we're doing like half days in the classroom, and we show up and he goes, Tosh comes in and his sort of like, you know, very punctuated speech style says,
yeah,
all right, grab a water source, meet out back. And somebody goes, what if we didn't bring a water source? He's like, you should always have a water source. I guess you learned, huh? And it's like July.
Yeah.
In Quantico, we go out back, you know, drop our blouses, run over to what was called the NATO O course, which was like this obstacle course, you know, kind of across the way by this big LZ. And behind it was this trail called Washboard. I think Washboard was like,
is that part of the endurance course? Is that kind of
No. Okay. Washboard's on the other side, okay. And it's a gravel trail that's literally just hills, you know, like a washboard. And I think it was like two and some change, maybe pushing 3 miles out to this one point. And we take off, and Tosh does not run slower than like a 6:15.
And you're in boots, right? You're in boots.
Yeah, we're in boots and utes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And dude, he takes off and everybody sprints and keeps up, and then he stops. And so it's like, oh, thank God, you know, we're not going to just run forever. He's like, all right, we made it in, you know, 20 minutes. How long is it going to take us to get back? And of course, Nitwit's like 19:30. And he's like, okay. So we sprint back and we make it in like 21 minutes, right? Or whatever the time was. And he's like, always a price for failure, yeah? And he points at somebody else. How long is it going to take us to get back out?
Oh.
They're like, and this person says like 20 minutes.
So, oh, my God.
Yeah. So we
thank you, sir. May I have another?
Yeah. Yeah.
So at the end, we get back out there the last time. And he asks me, he's like, how long is it going to take us to get back? And I was like, 20, it's like 28 minutes.
Yeah.
He's like, that's unacceptable. And we take off at his pace and we get back, we're done. But I mean, I think we logged something like 12 miles, you know, 10 to 12 miles. We get back to the classroom. I'm smoked. Like, look, I was never built to run long distances fast. You put a ruck on my back and, you know, have me go 4 or 5 miles an hour, I can do it all day. But we get back to this classroom and I have to stand up in the back. I'm like about to fall asleep. I'm probably like legitimately a heat case at that point.
Yeah.
And I literally fall asleep standing up and my knees buckle and I catch myself on this AC unit. Mm-hmm. And I just remember him staring at me and he said something. I don't remember what he said. I'm probably glad I don't, but I just remember thinking like, this is going to be the longest 10 weeks of my life. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that saved us was he went on to do an eco challenge and like crushed the soles of his feet. And so he couldn't run anymore. So we had to PT ourselves and it was, but man, learning the fundamentals of being an infantry officer from that guy and the rest of his staff. I mean, Jay Lappy, who, you know, you met out in Colorado, Chris. He was part of that staff at first. Isaac Moore was out there. Seth McCutcheon was out there. Brendan Sullivan, Danner. I mean, there were Gary Cobb, who I worked with later. I mean, the staff that they had were the knowledge we took away from those guys so
all,
far.
At that point, probably all combat veterans, right?
Yep. Yep. Yeah, so. And it just so far exceeded what was just in the pubs. You know, I mean, we got some very real, you know, they used to call it kneecap to kneecap mentoring from them. And it was, dude, it was unreal. Made you really hungry. And I was just lucky because like the guys in my squad were just like badass. And at the end of the day, like half of us ended up over at MARSOC. I've got a great picture from a buddy's wedding. You know, it's like almost our whole IOC squad. We're all, you know, over at the Raider Battalions.
Stay tuned for the second part of our interview with Tyson Stahl as he explores his combat tours as well as his days as a MARSOC Raider. We also get into discussion about his post-military career and his musical endeavors with Silence and Light and the charity work he's done with that band.